Since this podcast was recorded, the AHSN network has been renamed the Health Innovation Network. To find out more about the new names of the local health innovation networks described in this discussion as academic health science networks, visit thehealthinnovationnetwork.co.uk.
We've all learned a lot since the coronavirus pandemic.
Rather than sit at a desk and tell the community what they need, it was a program that came into the community, and I think that made the difference.
New ways of working involving digital technology are now commonplace. COVID-19 also highlighted the need for more equal care for all.
We've seen disproportionate deaths from COVID-19 between those living in deprived areas and those in least deprived areas. But we've also seen staggering ethnic inequalities across the healthcare in the pandemic in the NHS.
Innovation during a crisis is hugely important, but so too is taking time to evaluate new models of care to make sure future services are set up in the best way for everyone, including the health and care teams that provide them.
And I think when you talk to healthcare innovators and managers in these services, the struggles they have are not about money, they're not about technology, it's actually about culture and acceptance.
The NHS Insights Prioritisation Programme, or NIP for short, is funded by NHS England's Accelerated Access Collaborative and jointly run by the Applied Research Collaborations and the AHSN Network. This rapid evaluation programme has been set up specially to look at 14 different innovation projects to see how best to take them forward post-pandemic.
There were kind of multiple steps to what we did. And first of all, we actually took a step back and we wanted to make sure that we were completely aware of what research evidence existed in this space of trying to improve targeted vaccination in underserved groups.
We'll hear how health inequalities are being highlighted and tackled.
The more we listen to patients and carers, the better we get at doing things in a way that's acceptable and that not just hits the target, but meets the point as well.
In this series of podcasts, we've heard from health colleagues from across the country how the programme has helped make a difference. I'm Nigel Thompson, and in this final episode of the series, we'll be hearing from some of those who've contributed and get a reaction and comment from Tayo Awaduni, the NHS Programme Manager for AHSN Commissions, specifically the Innovation, Research and Life Sciences Group. Well, Tayo, first of all, thank you very much for joining us. Just out of interest, tell us about your experience with the NHS and how you joined this organisation.
Thank you very much, Nigel. Well, I joined the NHS England specifically in 2020, right in the middle of the pandemic, to take up the role as Academic Health Sciences Network Program Manager. The short form for that is AHSN. Prior to that, I worked in Public Health England specifically. It's changed its name and is now known as the UK Health Security Agency. I was involved with developing and delivering projects and leading various aspects of programs related to environmental public health. Actually, my last assignment in Public Health England was my contribution to COVID-19 outbreak during the response. I was part of the COVID-19 test and trace program, and part of my role was to provide program management support and input to what was a multi-agency testing cell. When you get all the data coming in at number 10 or from scientists at every single day, I was part of the team that would collate a lot of the data coming in from test sites and from labs. And that included a lot of partnership with NHS England. But actually, my first stint with the NHS was way back over a decade ago when I joined the Buckinghamshire Primary Care Trust.
So a very varied career so far. And I suppose when it comes to this area of work as well, the fact that you're looking at NHS Insights Prioritisation Programme, this sounds like you were kind of made for this job because of your previous experience. Just tell us a bit more about the NHS Insights Prioritisation Programme. Where did the idea come from? And practically, how have you been involved in rolling it out?
Yes. The role that I do for the AHSN programme is quite multifaceted. It involves national coordination of the whole Academic Health Science Network programs, particularly new programs and national programs, and also with commissions related to the Office for Life Sciences and Patient Safety. That has to do with a lot with the assurance of these programs. And NIP was one of the programs that I was tasked to lead on from the NHS perspective. Now, when you ask where the idea for NIP came from, the business case for the NHS Insight Prioritization Program came about as a response to clear research and development gaps that were identified during COVID years, at the start of COVID, actually, and a need to find out what insights of value could be gained from high-impact innovations evolving at the time, and to find out new ways of working that were either catalyzed, developed, deployed, or born out of necessity from all the disruptions the COVID-19 pandemic triggered on healthcare delivery. So we recognize that the pandemic caused healthcare systems to respond in different ways by finding new solutions just to keep delivering vital services to local populations. The NIP program was set up to prioritize and evaluate some of these innovations with a clear aim to generate shareable insights that benefit the NHS. We had a particular interest on ICS's integrated care systems that were developing at the time, but also to all our various stakeholders. We wanted to determine which promising innovations were finding the right solution to complex and urgent system challenges, and what aspects of those innovative approaches and discoveries are worth keeping post-COVID. This will help the NHS, obviously. If we found solutions like that, they will help build further service resilience and deliver so many benefits. So NIP was incubated during the lockdown, and it takes further what at the time was new ideas coming out of the Beneficial Changes Network, which, as its name implies, is a collective of different stakeholders across this ecosystem who were keen to look at the potential gains emerging from COVID outbreak responses. And this was under the auspices of the NHS Accelerated Access Collaborative, which is the bigger umbrella group where I am from. And this particular part of healthcare delivery is a very big multi-agency, force for good approach, bringing together the good and great from industry, from government, from regulators, also from patients, and across the NHS to look for ways to remove barriers and to accelerate the introduction of groundbreaking treatments and diagnostics in healthcare.
That's really good to hear, Ty. I mean, I think throughout this whole series, we've been, pleasantly surprised by the variety of activities that are underway and the innovation that's been kind of brought to the fore, partly because of the pandemic, but maybe accelerated in part because of it as well. So throughout the series, we've been met some fascinating guests, as I'm sure you're aware. We've also been very kind to share their experiences and learning. One example I've got for you is Professor Dame Caroline Watkins, who's Professor of Stroke and Older People's Care within the University of Central Lancashire's Faculty of Health and Care. She told us in episode 4 of this series a little bit more about a project that she's been involved in and the difference it's made.
Some of the babies that are born preterm, even those that are born sort of 34 weeks onwards, that's called sort of late preterm babies, they have problems feeding, perhaps with a little bit of breathing, so they need a bit of oxygen, and they often have jaundice and things that need sorting out. And normally all those things would require them to stay in hospital. So being in hospital is great, and you've got, you know, all the experts around you, but it means that you can't relax in the same way with your new baby. And so enabling people to go home by giving them extra support with their feeding, helping them to perhaps have oxygen at home, to be able to have perhaps light therapy at home, have somebody on the line for additional support over the phone, those things have enabled people not just to go home earlier with their babies. But if they're worried about things, they've got somebody that they can quickly ring up and get support for without them having to go back into the hospital. And so people have thought that was, you know, very important thing that happened during COVID, and thought that it was a really important thing to try and carry on.
That's Professor Dame Caroline Watkins from the University of Central Lancashire. And Tayo, when it comes to whether it's preterm babies or other aspects of care, I wonder, you know, when do, or how do you think examples of projects like this that were born in the pandemic by necessity become the norm?
I think I'd agree with her that these are kind of programs or projects that we should find ways to carry on with. Being innovative was going to be a central pillar to all aspects of life during the lockdown days. It's actually quite refreshing to hear stories like the one shared by Professor Dame Caroline Watkins and all our other colleagues. Their evaluation effort provides good evidence base on innovative approaches that have evolved and that the lockdown experience helped crystallize and test out. This particular project, the neonatal early supported transfer home project that was referred to in the clip, is one to showcase really. It's an example of joint evaluation projects that work between agencies like the Innovation Agency in the Northwest and their coterminous partners, the ARC, the Applied Research Collaborative, right there in the Northwest Coast. And they worked closely with so many other partners, including the Northwest Neonatal Operational Delivery Network. Leveraging on those resources, they succeeded in identifying best practice models for care in a safe way, particularly for preterm babies. Trying to get this baby into home settings, despite their additional support needs. I think this was done by being innovative, removing barriers, and forcing new creative solutions that provide safety, but also allowed for people to have their babies at home where it was safe and comfortable, rather than being in hospitals. Well, the evidence shows that it's always better for people and more cost-effective to that people are able to have services in communities or in the home where possible, rather than long hospital stays where it is clinically safe to do so. So the opportunity to scale up promising innovations like this will really help alleviate unnecessary hospital admissions. It will really help reduce the length of stay that people have to go through at the time of delivery. And also it keeps people as independent as possible in their own home. What broadly speaking, are the insights gained from such NIP evaluations open up new options for service improvement and for redesigning how care is delivered. You know, we can incorporate new ideas following the evidence, and case studies like this showcase real-world exemplars that can help those who are in health and social care circles, commissioners of services, people who make decisions on national programs. It provides just a bit of an armory for them to know that, oh, this kind of approach is quite effective. Through NIP, we also made the effort to encourage all our funded projects to link up with the relevant regional or national programs that were in their area of work, so that, yes, they could at least have a link to policy, they could have a link to those who procure services, and create that line of sight that allows for people to weigh up cost-effectiveness and impact. Well, this way, we create the opportunities for potential accelerated adoption of these ideas and their sustainability longer term.
That's good to hear, isn't it? Especially an area that where this is kind of thriving, and let's hope it's going to be rolled out across the country. Let's go from the northwest to the southeast. In the fourth podcast in this series, we also heard from Stuart Jeffrey. He works within the Kent, Surrey and Sussex NIHR Applied Research Collaboration. Now, he's looked at the beneficial changes arising from the COVID-19 pandemic and says when it comes to hospital discharges, he believes it's a change of culture that's needed.
Yeah, absolutely. And with this particular pathway, it's not just the hospitals, but it's as a pathway, it involves multiple providers in health and social care. And whilst the hospitals, you know, that they are they've got a frame of reference of when somebody can go home, actually changing that and changing their understanding of the risks that can be managed in the community is something that, you know, we found still needs to happen in places. So as a community person, you can kind of look at someone and say, yeah, that we can manage that. And but if you've spent your life working in a hospital, sometimes you know those edges don't quite meet. And similarly, so some people will go through a bedded facility, perhaps a nursing home or a residential home, for a short period. And actually, rather than just admitting somebody to be supported there, making sure that the culture within that home is one of enablement rather than pure supportiveness. So helping people get back on their feet, in effect. That does take a bit of change and a bit of a culture change.
So Stuart Jeffrey there basically saying there's a need for, as he calls it, a cultural change. What's your reaction? Do you think there still is some way to go?
Oh, thanks for bringing that up. Yes, I would agree with Stuart. Clearly, culture change is a significant challenge when it comes to implementing and spreading innovation. Even when it comes from strong evidence base, and these are validated interventions, at times, having clear evidence is just not enough. And neither does it translate as neatly or linearly into the real world adoption, you know, when these things are developed. And so Stuart is quite right that supporting the change management, the implementation of, you know, the issues with delivery, implementation, adoption and spread, embedding long-lasting quality improvement methodologies or new practices are all related to culture change. And these pose different challenges to commissioners, pose different challenges to practitioners. But doing things differently sits at the core of the NHS long-term plan. Indeed, two out of the key priorities, NIP has four key themes. Number one was use of remote monitoring. The second one is use of remote consultation. The third one, new approaches to delivering services. And the fourth is the NHS and social care's workforce, dealing with NHS and social care workforce issues. So new approaches to delivering services and supporting delivery and dealing with issues around workforce in the health and social care area are things that border on culture change. They are related. And these are cross-cutting themes across all the projects that that are being delivered or being implemented. So the emphasis needs to shift and to change to supporting a culture of innovation in a systematic way. As with a lot of new innovations, new approaches like this, like the ones Stuart mentioned, they require significant change, a significant push to the system. So change management approaches, including behavioral change management solutions, need to be carefully weighed and used to secure buy-in across all the relevant constituencies relevant to pushing out a particular innovation or adopting it. So these are often very complex issues that sometimes result in low uptake of something we know works. But the causes behind this are sometimes quite hard to pin down completely. I think, as Stuart said, these are aspects that remain work in progress for all of the NHS, the HSNs, and all the partners involved.
So watch this space, I suppose, is a message there. You mentioned about doing things differently. In the first episode of the series, we heard about digital monitoring and how it's expanded during and immediately after the pandemic. Now, one of those who shared their story with us was Tracy Marriott. She's the Director of Clinical Innovation Adoption for the Oxford AHSN. And she told us more about the reaction to changes to stroke services that have taken place in her region.
What we've subsequently found is that as we went through the programme, we interviewed patients and we interviewed clinicians as to what their preferences were and what were some of the barriers for working either virtually or on a face-to-face basis. The traditional model of patients is face-to-face, and some patients think they are getting a lesser service by being seen virtually and are willing to travel far distances and manage complicated personal arrangements to be seen in clinic. For some patients, some TIA patients, being seen is very important because it gives them reassurance and confidence. On the clinician side, many clinicians also realize that there are benefits for face-to-face because they can obviously, you know, physically see the patient. However, there are opportunities from other models of care where there's a mix of virtual and face-to-face to manage the resource situation.
Trace Marriott there. And I guess that's the, what she's saying is kind of is fairly obvious, isn't it? There is a mix and there always will be a mix. Digital won't replace face-to-face. What are your thoughts in this area?
Yes, absolutely. The COVID-19 outbreak put significant pressure on healthcare systems all over the world. This resulted in major changes to how healthcare is being delivered or will continue to be delivered post-pandemic. You know, by harnessing these tools, exponential multiplier effects of digital technologies that exist today and data science, we can improve how people access services and improve the way care is provided. There is no doubt about that. So the NHS is very big on digital transformation across the system. It's part of the long-term plan. For instance, digital monitoring, remote monitoring has significantly bolstered the emergence of what we now know as community virtual ops or virtual wards or virtual clinics. These approaches are driving efficiency and they're freeing up hospital beds. They are opening up clinician time and they are reducing COVID backlogs. They are reducing the A&E attendance, for instance. But like Tracy said, so for some complex, complicated conditions, digital just doesn't deliver the 100% solution. They in their evaluation of TIA, they found that providing a mixed model, a hybrid approach of solutions that could range from the traditional face-to-face hospital consultation to more digital remote monitoring solutions are what the patients and the clinicians still want. And really listening to the voices and the needs of key groups like patients and clinicians is very important. Here, we know and we are finding that it's not a one-size-fits-all. And for patient benefit and for an effective service, there may be situations where we keep an hybrid solutions and we keep these solutions working side by side with the digital telemedicines and digital monitoring technologies so that we can ensure the best outcome. This itself, what this particular project has delivered is very interesting. It's an interesting discovery.
You mentioned patient benefits. I think one of our other additions, which we'll perhaps talk about now, very much we're hearing loud and clear from patients, or I should say families of patients, what difference it's made. One of the recurring themes from this whole series has been communication within health and social care and certainly within the community. In the episode which examined work to tackle health inequalities, we heard from the inspirational, because she was really, Sandra Tomlinson. She's a lay educator working in South London. And she talked about work with the Afro-Caribbean community and those at risk of developing type 2 diabetes. The HEAL-D project has successfully reached the community, as Sandra herself explained.
One of the things I think in terms of approaching health, and especially with this community, was that Louise, and which I think made me respect the program more than anything else, was the fact that it was a program that came into the community to find out what the community wanted, rather than, and I always phrase it as, rather than sit at a desk and tell the community what they need. And I think that made the difference, and a very big difference, because now people felt part of it, part of the research from beginning to end. And yeah, how should I put it? Designed by the community, developed by the community, for the community.
And what difference has it made?
It's made, well, from feedback, it's made a lot of difference. Working on the program, I see the differences. It's a 7-week course which combines lifestyle education, physical activity, to help the attendees develop a healthy lifestyle changes. The lifestyle changes, really, they're aware of them already. The thing is, what the information that's been provided for them that's vital and not out there is, what do they do with the foods that they know and eat? And that has always been the most important thing, I think, for me and the attendees, that we are now have access to that information, which we didn't have before.
Sandra Tomlinson, it's a good news here, Tyre, but I wonder how frequent are stories of success like this?
Well, we need to hear more. A lot more. We need more of those stories. It's fantastic to hear about HealD. I've actually followed this project closely and found opportunities to promote it at bigger forums as an example, exemplar of this NIP program. As we've heard from Sandra, she put it eloquently, you know, from this work, we learn a lot about what is possible when good co-production, patient and public involvement and engagement, PPIE as they call it, and excellent community development best practice are delivered very well. That this is an example for others that can be others to learn from. Targeted communities need a lot of engagement. They are not hard to reach. They are underserved. And this is what Sandra has expressed, that co-development is a positive approach that allows for success to emerge. Well, they achieved this principally by incorporating their local communities and bringing the high value of lived experiences into the project right from the get-go, right from the co-design, right from the development and through the life cycle. This, along with, you know, such excellent project management across the different projects with a lot of rigor for research, they've been able to articulate and communicate their vision, unique vision, to their beneficiaries. And this is all this co-production engagement, they are the likely success for this project. And they've won awards for this. It's one of the projects that's already been peer reviewed. There's so much success stories coming out from projects like this. And the COVID-19 pandemic highlighted the prevalence and the impact of health inequalities in society, with higher COVID-19 risks evident among particular underserved communities, ethnic minority communities. However, the focus in addressing this problem is becoming even much more vogue because there's a lot of accelerated innovations that are targeted to reduce inequalities and to spread innovations to communities that more than ever before. And HSNs, they do have a track record for promoting health inequalities, working with their partners. And I know that they have situated health inequalities firmly on their business plan for the next few years. So the answer is yes, it will get more frequent to hear more of this. And we need to hear more success stories coming in months and years to come in other parts of the country as well, not just in London. For HSNs, they are all working hard to promote what we know as the NHS Core 20 plus 5 in health inequalities framework that was developed by the NHS Health Inequalities Improvement Team. But really, beyond NIP, beyond the NIP program, HSNs actually deliver on a lot of other health inequalities activity. There is a program called the Innovation for Healthcare Inequalities Program, INHIP, as it is known for short. This particular program has been running for a year now, and it focuses attention of local partners, particularly at the ICS level, on ways to accelerate access to innovations for target underserved populations in their area. And they choose 5 clinical areas, and I'm aware that, you know, that many of the ICSs have embraced this approach. I think there are, at the last count, 39 projects across the 42 ICSs that have been funded and supported. HSNs are continually increasing their catalogue of activities they are delivering in this space, health inequalities and healthcare delivery. And I believe that they're using all opportunities to share these stories.
The problem continues, and it's been good to hear, isn't it, even in a short period of time, just a little insight into the various programmes that are underway and the differences that they're making. This series has certainly highlighted those. But I wonder, when it comes to the future of the NHS Insights Prioritisation Programme, what does the future hold? How do you see it progressing over the next coming months and years?
We've been tracking all the progress of all 14 projects to be funded, working closely with the HSN Central Office and the ARC and HSN Steering Group, which is a group that comprises of system leaders and senior level subject matter experts who provide a steer and some governance for NIP. But all indications point to the success of all the projects that I've gone through. And by extension, we are seeing benefits to the overall program approach. The feedback that we're getting is overwhelmingly positive from our various participants and even observers across the patch. All of this indicate that this approach for co-production between researchers in the ARC and brokers and project leaders and influencers that HSNs are in their local area should be promoted a lot more. And we have this new opportunity for rigorous real-world evaluation studies to be conducted in short cycles and to encourage cross-system collaboration. So these kind of projects, they actually can deliver when you require a lot of rigor in your evaluation exercise. I think all the projects have now complete. They are now completed after about 18 months. And we are receiving final reports. They filtered through. And we now have the opportunity to review the outcomes of all the projects we've funded and try to make sense of how it's gone. I'm sure there are lessons to be learned about what's worked well and the benefits that have been realized. Some of them you've already described today and we've celebrated today through this podcast. But there will also be areas for improvement. There will also be things that we can do to address systemic barriers and weaknesses that are brought to our attention through this program. So NIP also commissioned an independent review of the whole program to a third-party agency just to try to give an unbiased opinion of how things have transpired. We expect that their recommendations will form part of our final assessment. And the whole NIP program for collaboration is really a strong business case for investing, or if not investing, facilitating rapid cycle insights generation that are able to answer those questions the NHS and its stakeholders need answers to in pretty much rapid cycles. Then we get to know how to commission, what we should commission, and sometimes even what we should decommission that are not working so well. But in final point for me is to say that the next key step for us for the NIP program is to see the effective dissemination of the products, the outputs, the insights, guides that have been generated by each of these projects to their target audience. And this will expectedly be ICSs at the local level, that's integrated care boards and integrated care systems, the regional and national commissioners of the programs related to their work, and also decision makers, people in academia who are looking at this approach as something that allows for implementation science and the ability to actually provide guidance in a rapid way with research rigor that allows for us to determine how successful projects are going or would go. Obviously, patients also need to find out about new treatments that are coming through the pipeline. Obviously, the general public can also learn from this. So that's where we're hoping this should go. So, but watch this space, as you said earlier on.
Well, Well, thanks to all the guests who've taken part in this series. It's been a really good insight into what's going on all across the country. As you say, just a snapshot of just some of the 14 different projects underway. And thank you to you as well for your time. I'm sure that this podcast will hopefully inspire others to learn a bit more about what's going on. And if you have been inspired, you'd like to learn more, the NHS Insights Prioritisation Programme, the web page on the HSN Network website is available and perhaps a good place to head to. But Tayo, just finally, you've been talking about your career at the start of this conversation, a very varied career. I mean, this must be quite an interesting part to be involved in, the fact that you're involved in such a wide and varied range of projects.
Oh, yes. This is really cutting edge of science, of innovation. This is, you know, being part of something bigger, a bigger output that allows for the NHS to deliver quicker, faster access to services and get technologies and solutions to the hands of patients and to the hands of clinicians, so we all can enjoy good health care. It's been fantastic to be involved with this program, and thank you for helping us to promote it.
Good to talk, Tayo. Thanks very much for your time. That's Tayo Awadunnu, the NHS Programme Manager for the AHSN Commissions. Thanks indeed again for joining us. And as I said, also thanks to all our guests who've taken part in this series. I'm Nigel Thompson. Until next time, thanks for listening.